pleasure to welcome Nick Barashev back to the show, CEO of Bullion Management Group and author of $10,000 Gold, Why Gold's Inevitable Rise is the Investor's Safe Haven. I have two hard copies here, published, I think, in 2013. It's hard to believe it's been that long. Welcome back, Nick Barashev.
Thing is, when the book came out, I was like a lone wolf in the wilderness talking about $10,000 gold. Now, got all kinds of people, including Jim Rickards. He's talking anywhere from $10,000 to $50,000. You know, a lot of other people are talking the same kind of numbers, and they obviously, in terms of the possibility of a major reset in the pricing and so on, something that's becoming more mainstream and doesn't seem to be kind of a way out there theory or anything like that.
Firstly, we're very excited to have you on the show today, as well as you mentioned Jim Rickards. We have a scheduled October interview, his debut here on the show. It's interesting that he's calling for this sort of freeze of the monetary system. And maybe that's a good segue into one of the topics we were discussing before the show, the idea of Bitcoin and cryptos as digital money. We believe that it's just a natural evolution of fiat money.
It could be like, for instance, China intends to use the blockchain to create its own fiat money. So that's a possibility. But private cryptocurrencies, I studied that at length. There's been all kinds. And then what eventually happens, because the initial attraction is the anonymity of using them, but then what happens is the money launderers, drug dealers, and pornographers start using them. And whether you get set up with one of those or they're real guys, then, you know, the boys come down and shut down the operation. And if they can find anybody to arrest, they will. Look at what happened to the Liberty Dollar. That was an actual silver dollar. The second thing, you know, whether it's fiat currency or cryptocurrencies, and we're all becoming too complacent with the security of the computer systems. Like a couple of years ago in Australia, half the banks used a certain software for the banking systems. And there was a glitch developed in that. During a two-week period, you were locked out of your bank account, your credit cards, your debit cards, anything. So even for a space of 2 weeks, unless you had physical currency, you had a real problem for 2 weeks. And the latest thing, this hacking at Equifax, just goes to show. So to have my wealth or, you know, my money in a digital system where I don't own anything but computer digits, that it's replaced with the SDR, which to some extent can be looked at as an improvement over a single reserve currency like the US dollar, that you've got a basket of currency. So that's okay for the short term, but where that leads us to is a one world currency.
Yeah, and you brought up the interesting development there in China, of course, with Iran and several of their trading partners essentially rejecting the greenback in favor of a gold and oil-backed currency.
Well, China can pull it off because that's what happened to Saddam Hussein, was going to price oil in euros, and then Omar Gaddafi was going to create an African, you know, gold currency. So we saw what happened. That's the issue where it's critical for the U.S. to maintain its reserve status and to price primarily oil. Tried to move off the U.S. dollar. Now what you've got is a giant mess of a failed state. They were better off with the dictators, you know, the people. So that's the thing. So now we have China, and to a certain extent with Russia's cooperation and some of the other countries. So they set up an exchange where they're pricing oil in yuan. Now, yuan, you know, got enough confidence to sell your oil in yuan, but they've now set it up so that the yuan is convertible to gold. So that's a whole new ballgame. And the real risk is that if Saudi Arabia moves to price Saudi oil in different currencies, then the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency has a big, big problem.
Oh, we agree with you. We think that the reserve currency will never likely eclipse the recent peak that we saw in the last couple of years. We see a confluence of negative factors, including the cryptos. The entire fiat currency system will be overturned. You and I discussed this a bit, that China is the first country to develop an institute solely for the study of cryptocurrencies. So they're obviously interested and have made some public comments, both China and Russia, in a national blockchain currency. How might that impact your theories?
You know, blockchain as a technology could be considered an improvement on fiat currencies, but the problem is the governments aren't going to allow private cryptocurrencies. Like, once they get successful enough one way or another, they'll be shut down. I mean, they've got a monopoly to do fiat currencies. They're not going to have competition for that monopoly.
Of course, we agree with you here. The precious metals are the most solid currency. But there is, I think, an interesting argument in the pro column, if you will, for cryptos. You might even say it's a refutation of the negative factors. We hear a lot about how nefarious practices are turning to the crypto space, but I could make the argument that the typical big city ATM machine supplies more currency for negative transactions than the cryptos.
That, of course, is what they're trying to, moving toward elimination of cash so that they solve that problem. That's a serious concern if they get to pull that off, but that's the intended direction.
Let's move on now, if we could, to your $10,000 gold. Seeing good signs of that in 2017, positive technicals in the precious metals shares, as well as silver, gold, platinum, palladium.
When you look at it in terms of this year to date, gold's one of the best performing asset classes, like outperforming the equities and so on. So we're already there. But the real risk now is that we've got this triple bubble. From my recollection, that's not happened in my career. The only time that we could be anywhere close to that is 1929. But we've got a real estate bubble. You know, I've basically been in the real estate business most of my life, and I've never seen a bubble so absurd as it has been, over the last couple of years. Then, followed by bonds, which, unless we go to negative interest rates, have got nowhere to go but down once the interest rates correct and the stock markets are reaching 1929 bubble valuations. To compound the problem, we've got a mountain of debt and derivatives that all this is sitting on top of. So when we look at the Fed's balance sheet and the S&P 500, it's almost a perfect correlation. The reason the S&P has gone up, not because of improved earnings or outlooks, is because the Fed has thrown a lot of money into the system, and when it didn't show up in inflation, but it showed up in, asset appreciation. So the thing is, if we look at previous bubbles, like 1999 was an equity bubble, primarily in NASDAQ stocks, and then 2007, 2008 was a real estate bubble. But there's never been one where we've got like a simultaneous bubble. And if any one of those three pops, it'll take the other two down with it. And people are complacent because there comes a time like when you shouldn't be invested because your upside is relatively minimal compared to your downside. If you take a 50% hit, you need 100% to recover. And if you're a baby boomer,
exactly.
Basing that, like if you go to 1999, the FANG stock, so to speak, at the time, were Cisco, IBM, Intel, Microsoft, and Oracle. Now, if you happen to be invested in them in 1999, you broke even with IBM in 2007, so that took you 7 years. You broke even in Microsoft in August 2016, and Oracle you broke even in 2017. And the others, you haven't even broken even yet. So that's the FANG stocks of 1999. Now, the companies were good companies. There's earnings, growth, profit, growth, everything. They're all still around and doing well. But the stock price was absurd in 1999. And we've got the same sort of thing in today's FANG stocks. Amazon's a good company, Netflix, etc. They're all good companies that will probably do well. But you as an investor won't do well if you're invested when they correct. People don't think about it as there's times to not be invested for the little bit of hanging in there for that minuscule upside that might happen from here on in. You're risking a 50 to a 70% hit.
Yeah, you'll recall what Edwin Lefebvre wrote, that the most expensive ticks in the market were the top and the bottom ticks, because folks, they chase those 2 points so much.
They think, well, if the market corrects, I'll see the top and then I'll get out. But oftentimes the market corrects like quickly and you have a 10% hit, and then people say, well, I'll wait till that corrects and then I'll get out. And instead of correcting to the upside, it takes another 20% down. So then they say, well, I've got a 30% loss, so I don't want to sell now. but, you know, there'll soon be a correction, and they keep waiting that out until they're like 50 to 70% down, you know, and that's how it, you know, typically goes. But it's a very dangerous time to be in. It's unprecedented.
I'd like to maybe focus on this idea you bring up, this trifecta of bubbles. And I think we could probably make a case for several other bubbles, but important key multi-decade bubbles. Okay. This is not just a flash in the pan, you know, stocks, which supposedly corrected during the 2000s, but it was just a plateau, if you will, for this exponential move. And then you bring up bonds and you bring up real estate. And Dr. Robert Shiller at Yale just corroborated your thoughts that he just cannot believe what this echo bubble in real estate and the S&P. So he's backing up your thoughts there.
This market is completely unaffordable by the population. There's like an income to debt ratio and price ratio, and those are all way offline that can't be handled.
Wouldn't you agree the bulk of investors and retirees and pensioners have parked their hard-earned wealth? If those three safe havens fail, what are the implications?
Well, the trouble is that most investors have a double whammy, because when those three fail, not if they fail, the pension funds that are already failing, I mean, the pension funds are failing when we had a bull market. What's going to happen when we have a bear market? Your savings get decimated, your real estate gets decimated, and you get a letter from the pension company that, sorry, we're going to have to cut your pension checks. Which has already happened numerous times.
You were the first on our 12-year broadcast to correctly point out that the typical pension fund, anywhere from Tokyo, where you noted $4 trillion at the time, you know, the key focal financial centers, less than one-half of 1% of the overall funds were invested in precious metals, where the traditional benchmark was 10 to 15%.
Oh, that's right, and we've done a lot of number crunching on what the magic number is, and the magic number actually turns out to be 20, because at 20%, you've got a nice balance between volatility and return. If you go over 20%, your volatility increases, but so does your return, and so on. So the best compromise is 20%, and that's really all. Gold's a complicated story when you get into the monetary aspects, but this is quite simple. The issue of 20% doesn't matter what the volatility of gold is. When you put it in a portfolio, it reduces the volatility of the portfolio because of the negative correlation. That's the main thing to understand. So if the market corrects and you've got 20%, you'll probably still take a hit, but it'll be a minimal hit compared to not having any gold. But the second thing is that if you're not invested, like let's say right now you just liquefy all your investments and you wait for the market to crash. You imagine the kind of bargains that you can buy? Can you remember the bargains that were at the bottom of 2008? So for the fact that you're not going to be invested for a few months or even a year, you'll have the opportunity of a lifetime to buy your favorite stocks at 50, 60, 70% off. Then you make money. There's nothing written that you always have to be invested. There's times when you shouldn't be invested.
Aren't we really caught due to this artificially low interest rate environment you've alluded to? -3 to 3.7%. We've never seen that, as by now it's almost a broken record on the show. It's never occurred in financial history. You know, I give you my money and pay you for the courtesy. And so what folks are caught up, I think you'd agree here, they're trying to chase return, any type. You're battling inflation and then you're battling the lack of return. You know, Mr. Nick Barishef has proven here mathematically or statistically that you need this ballast in your keel that will keep your ship afloat, and it's only going to require 20% of your portfolio, and they yawn. And so how can we convince them today that that 20% is a free lunch to protect them, an insurance policy?
That's right, because unlike an insurance policy, which is an expense, when you buy gold as a portfolio insurance, it tends to rise in terms of appreciation. So it's basically free insurance that gives you a return. Now, the return isn't in dividends or interest. The return is in capital gain and in purchasing power.
It's a self-perpetuating policy with a return attached. You might think of it as coupons and potential for capital gains. It actually eclipses the value of the typical insurance policy.
That's right. That's the thing. And then, you know, from a capital gain perspective, there's a very simple thing to understand. So last day or so, the World Gold Council announced that gold production is essentially peaked. And the mining industry is only able to kind of replace current mines, but they're not increasing production. And I forget what the numbers are offhand, but it's something like there's $260 trillion of financial assets and something like $150 billion in gold. Sooner or later, part of that $260 trillion of paper assets is going to move to gold. Now, given that the mining industry can't produce any more gold, and a lot of gold is already held in very strong hands, the only adjusting factor is price, and that's when the price goes ballistic.
Well, let's take your number for a moment. We've seen some numbers just thrown around, but let's just assume that the typical gold market is roughly $1 trillion. And you're talking about $220 trillion that might go searching for such a safe haven.
I mean, you just take 5 or 10% of the $220 trillion, the gold price has to go up multiples just for a minuscule increase. The average allocation to gold, private hands, is less than 1%, and in institutional hands is less than 0.5%. And I'm saying that the optimal number is 20%. It was 20% in the 70s. That's what institutions held. You can run the numbers. It's not a paid or an opinion. You can take any portfolio you want, set up the model, and then include whatever, 5, 10, 15, 20% return, and you'll see the return improves, the volatility goes down, the Sharpe ratio improves, and the Sortino ratio improves. So it's not a question of opinion or being a gold bug. It's just a fact.
It is, and I think it really doesn't circle us right back to the point that people don't find that fact sexy. But who would own a car, a new car, or a new home without insurance? It's not a sound practice.
And you have like a 10 to 20% allocation, so you have some level of portfolio insurance. I mean, you can do portfolio insurance by doing, you know, puts and so on and so forth, but that's too complicated for the average investor and the average financial advisor. So that's, the hedge funds can do that, but just, you know, buy and hold a certain percentage of gold. I found that gold has generally a negative bias amongst investors and financial advisors. The difference is, if I told you that I was going to give you $1 million and you can choose between a stack of $100 bills or a stack, an equivalent amount of gold, and there was only one catch, you couldn't touch it for 20 years. You know what people choose? Gold. I have never run across a single person.
By the way, if that's an offer today, I gladly accept. They're interested in stocks and Bitcoin and all these other bubbly sectors, or maybe in a high-yield bond portfolio, a fund or something with 5 or 6% yield. However, if you were to then say you're about to inherit $1 million, how would you allocate those funds? I'll bet you'd find that if you talked them through it, every case they would accept your 20%.
You know, leave a trust fund to your grandkids or something that they're not going to need for 20 years, and you looked at it that way, then, you know, just about everybody says gold, because they know that the purchasing power, whatever the number is, whether it's, you know, 10,000, 100,000, 2,000, doesn't matter, but it'll purchase you the same or more stuff than it can today, and that's the measure of it. It's not what it's worth in dollars, so it's irrelevant. It keeps moving around. It's what it can buy you in the future. And in my book, I have a table there that looked at the price of cars and houses in gold ounces back in the 70s and today, and the Dow in the 70s and the Dow in today. Well, in all cases, you get more stuff for the same number of ounces.
It's so well said. And the other interesting aspect of precious metals, anyone who's ever owned any, after the cash is gone, after the checking account has been emptied, after the brokerage account shows 20 penny stocks, in the final analysis, the precious metals just tend to remain in that safety deposit box or under the floorboards and hidden in the private stockpile. They stand the test of time.
I think that there's going to be some unfortunate, painful lessons learned by many of the people that don't take the time to, you know, explore this with an open mind. If you if you look into it with an open mind, you'll come to the same conclusion that I have. So
there's such a small fraction of the Western world that own any precious metals. I mean, look at some of the numbers, some of the statistics directly from our government, from the St. Louis Fed and other sources, Labor Department, that indicate something astounding number. Half of Americans live from paycheck to paycheck.
Half Americans don't have $500.
You're exactly right. Because it's easy for people, I think, in this sector who have been involved in the industry for so many decades to forget what it's like to sort of be caught in the system. Because hundreds of millions of people in the U.S., in Europe, in Asia, outside of North America, are caught in a system not necessarily of their making. And we may even intellectually realize it's flawed, but find it difficult to extricate our families.
That's right. So that's something that people should consider. Like I said, to me, you're at this point in time, the risk is too high to be invested, even if you're trying to get a point here and there. But the risk of loss is so... Well, when you look at all the equity measures, the Tobin rate, the Tobin indicator, the Buffett indicator, the Shiller ratio, all these things.
Sharpe ratio.
You're approaching 1929 levels.
I think they realized the system was literally hours away from unraveling into the abyss.
208 was just a warm-up of what's coming. And they need to do some research and stop listening to the mainstream news and look at any number of the alternative sites and start thinking for themselves. But many people won't do that, so there's nothing you can do about it. You can't convince them.
But let's say that half of Americans have some form of share ownership. I think I remember reading, this may have changed in the last decade, that roughly 150 million Americans had some exposure, most likely through their companies, pensions, programs, and stock ownership plans. But still, they have that feeling, my home price has gone up, and my shares, it's up maybe 100, 200% from 2009. But from a contrarian's perspective, not only is the opportunity cost high here for not owning the precious metals, but as the insurance you referred to, it really represents an incredible value.
Exactly.
Well, as we wrap up here today, sir, care to tell a little bit more about this fascinating $10,000 gold prediction from your magnum opus?
So the book is available on Amazon and Kindle, so it gives people a good basic overview of money and gold and everything works, so I encourage them. That would be a good starting point.
And would you say now that 3 or 4 years after its publishing that you feel the projection might have been overly conservative?
Well, yeah, because the debt has continued to go up.
Thank you, sir. Please return to the show.
Okay, bye now.
With stocks hitting new highs, the next sector to fly could be the precious metals. GoldSeek's top industry analyst just uncovered another solid gold opportunity, Silvercorp Metals. Silvercorp's key property is located in China, the largest gold producer in the world. Silvercorp's net income is soaring, up 589%. Production eclipsed guidance by 27.5%. totaling 6.5 million ounces. Mining operations are literally printing silver at only $3.82 per ounce. AISC net byproducts credits for the fiscal year 2017. Sales increased 51% year over year, and cash flow from operations more than doubled to $80 million. Silvercorp continues to set the industry standard with reduced costs, equity appreciation, a solid dividend, and improved free cash flow. Silvercorp is uniquely positioned to capitalize on rising silver, lead, and zinc prices. To learn more about the exceptional opportunity in Silvercorp Inc., direct your web browser to silvercorpmetals.com, ticker symbol SVM in the U.S. and Canada. Remember to treat your portfolio with a core position in Silvercorp Metals.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.